Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack. Welcome back, listeners. I am absolutely thrilled to be hosting best-selling author Garrett Conley for his fiction debut, All the World Beside. Garrett, I am so happy to see you. I am so honored that you took the time to talk to me and all of the listeners here at the Top Shelf podcast.
Well, I'm so honored to be here, Carol Ann. And what excited me most is when you showed me the book that was all marked up. I was like, people that read and care about sentences, I get to talk about sentences finally.
There will be no shortage of that in this interview, I assure you. And listeners who know, they know. And I just want to introduce everyone to you in case they are not aware. Garrett Conley is the New York Times bestselling author of the 2016 memoir, Boy Erased. He is also the creator and co-producer of the podcast, Unerased, The History of Conversion Therapy in America. And in addition to that, Garrett's work has been published by the New York Times, the Oxford American, Time, Virginia Quarterly Review, and more than I can even go on about in this podcast. He is also a graduate of Brooklyn College's MFA program that, of course, warms my heart particularly. While he was at Brooklyn College, he was a Truman Capote Fellow specializing in fiction. He currently serves as an assistant professor of creative writing at Kennesaw State University. Did I get that?
That was correct.
Lucky students. Garrett, again, thank you so much for taking this time with all of us. If you would, please tell us about All the World Beside.
So really, I began this project with a question that my husband posed about 8 years ago, right after Boy Erased came out, which sounds insane to me. Time is fake. But he said to me, why don't you write about queer Puritans? And I laughed. I thought it was a joke. You know, I was like, what are you doing trying to give me a career suicide? I have no idea how to do that. And I started, it was an idea that stuck in my head for many reasons, one of which is that I'm an Aries, so I'm very stubborn and I like the idea of doing something really hard and ambitious. And so I was like, okay, well, first of all, how do I get the language, right? How do I get the language of the 18th century in a modern, a contemporary book that readers would want to read? So I started to read people like Jonathan Edwards, these big preachers at the time. He had a very famous sermon that was really the first fire and brimstone sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which many of you listening might have had to read in high school. It's a very scary moment in literature. But he was actually known for being an Enlightenment thinker and a really methodical thinker. And once I dove into that world of these 18th century ministers, something opened up in me where I saw a kind of similarity to the way that my father thinks and the way that I was sort of raised to think in terms of, you know, even though we weren't as methodical or at all structured, my father's a Baptist preacher. So it's very different from the Congregationalists of the 18th century, of which Jonathan Edwards was part of. So I started to really find that fascinating. And then I thought, okay, well, now let's figure out queerness in the 18th century. Let's do that. And there were actually a lot of queer theorists who were very interested in the peer period. Michel Foucault, who we hear quoted all the time these days, he posited that homosexuality was invented in the 19th century. You know, he's being a little funny there, right? He's saying it's the first time that we really used that term and started to see ourselves in a different light. But if you trace it all back, it goes to the 18th century where gender and sexuality roles were formulated more together, right? So these two things were more uncoupled in the past. So gender expression was not always tied to sexuality. And then we had this new idea that the more effeminate a man was, the more, you know, whatever he was, that now we have the stereotype of him being gay. And so I was really interested in sort of bringing all those things together, but none of it would have been any good if I couldn't find the characters. And so I found my two main characters, a minister who falls in love with another man in his town, and then really the cast built around those two men. The supporting cast became the primary cast for me. Catherine, his wife, Sarah, his daughter, Ezekiel, his son, and the other man's wife. You know, these were the characters that became really important for me because I was getting tired of seeing stories that were just male-male love or intimacy, which, of course, that's my whole thing. I love it. But I did want something that was a little more kaleidoscopic and looked more at the period as a historical period for everyone. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I felt the most important part of the project became a sort of feminist project, where I understood that these women who were affected by this union and by the constraints of the time, the society at the time, you know, this was 40 years after Salem witch trial. So not that long. And I just became fascinated with this idea of what is the cost of freedom for different people? And are those costs greater for women? And spoiler alert, the answer is yes. but in that world, I did find a lot of joy and happiness. And I think the reason I was able to find a sense of joy within the book was that my own life had been circumscribed by the society we grew up in. It was a very small town, very scrutinizing place. And my father was a preacher. And so I was always watched. But I always managed to find these moments of beauty, usually in nature. We lived in the Ozarks in Arkansas. And so we would walk around and, you know, I would see, like, I would just sort of escape. You know, I think at the time I was a sort of budding transcendentalist. You know, I'd read about it. Read a lot of those dudes, and I enjoyed them. So I don't know. This was kind of an amalgam of everything that I've ever loved and feared. In a way, it feels like a strange book.
I mean, I understand what you're saying, that it feels like a strange book. I just dove right in. Kudos to your husband, or maybe not, for making you go back in time to this Puritan time period. There is so much tension because of that. Every page, like you're saying, every page, there's absolute joy and beauty and love. And then there are these scenes where I was on the edge of my seat. And those scenes were simple conversations. Garrett, come on now. I mean, there's a scene with Anne, and it's towards the beginning of the book. There's an awkward conversation that takes place, right? And it's Anne, Deborah, and Priscilla. And oh, that Deborah, boy, she has, oh gosh, she says, "We've not seen a miracle here in some time. Some might say there's a reason for it. A town must be free of certain impurities, I believe, before it may be saved." I will say I started perspiring at that moment. Because, of course, we know the irony. Anne knows, she's thinking maybe this is something to do with her husband. There's this verbal jousting that occurs. Talk about writing that scene. It seemed, like I said, it's so suspenseful, but it's a simple conversation.
Well, that was the challenge of the book, and honestly, my first book as well, because, you know, with Boy Erased, people were expecting electroshock therapy. They were expecting, you know, all the darkest parts of conversion therapy. And what I really wanted to put forward in my first book was that sense of dread and fear that can arise out of simple conversation. And there can be a kind of psychological torture that happens in these tiny communities. And Deborah is she's a minor character, but she plays a very important part in the book. And for me, she is that certain type of person in the church that is just up in everybody's business, and they're clever about it, right? They know how to sort of say things without saying them. And that's a very particular type that I grew up with. And I know, you know, that what's so great is that the 18th century is full of wit, right? When you're reading all those plays from the 18th century, it's just witty, witty, witty. So I was able to draw that out of my more cruel characters because they're mean.
She is. Oh my gosh. Yes. It's also the tension of, as you're saying, this 40 years after the Salem witch trials, the reader knows what's at stake here. And that also builds another kind of tension. You've got this very small town. It's just an unsettling time period in general, because it's hard to believe that that actually happened, that those are the formative years of the country, the uncertainty of colonial America on so many levels. But then I think of what we're going through right now and the uncertainty that I'm feeling every day of what we're, and I, before I knew we were going to have this conversation, I thought, oh my gosh, I feel like, what has changed?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was what was so shocking to me. I told you I started this book 8 years ago. You can't plan for these sorts of things, right? Like the new Puritanism that's taken over America, which it's never gone away.
Right.
It's just never gone away. But it was dormant for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us were very naive, including myself. And you know, I wasn't as naive as some because I knew that Trump was going to be elected in 2016, and I was telling everyone about it, and they were laughing at me when I was going on tour. You know, it's never good to be the bearer of bad news, but I felt that back then. But even within that, I thought, okay, well, that sort of thinking's not going to win this sort of dark era that we've gone into. And I think we're in an even darker one, and I don't even want to say that. But you look at the anti-trans legislation across the country, you look at the book bans. My book's been banned, like, you know, in all the southern states. Just got back.
You are in good company, though.
Yeah, exactly. We're a good group. But it's just, you know, I still don't think these people are going to win. But it's really not the people that I'm fighting anymore. It's this idea that America has to continue to be this way. And I mostly attack this from the right, like I'm looking at what the right is doing, but I also see it on the left in the way that we have, I don't want to use the cancel word, but you know, there is some of that that come in our group, and we don't offer grace very often on our side. We don't give people a chance to recuperate from what we've done to them. So I do find that it's just a really poignant perennial topic that never goes away, for better or worse, mostly worse. But I don't think I'd have a subject if I didn't live in this country. I mean, religion and sexuality, the tension between the two, the ways that it affects people, that'll probably always be my subject. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what else to do with it. I did, you know, this activism that I did for 8 years. When we started out, there were only two sites, I think, that had bans on conversion therapy. And now there are 25, I believe. And a lot of that is thanks to the work that we did with multiple LGBTQ organizations across the country. But I have seen all of it stall. Right. And installing at this gender issue. I know it's a complicated issue, but it's not so complicated that we can't still protect kids and make sure that conversion therapy doesn't happen. And also know that conversion therapy happens more times to a trans person than it's more likely for a trans person to go through it than a cis person. So it's just very frustrating. You know, my childhood idols have betrayed me. J.K. Rowling is, you know, out there doing her thing. And it's upsetting because at first I just tried to think, well, how do we convince somebody like that? She has such a platform. But then I realized she doesn't want convincing. She believes with her absolute certainty. And, you know, the UK is supposed to be the place where Puritanism died, but it didn't. They didn't stamp it out. It's still there.
And you mentioned it. It's so, protect our children. It's so easy to love them and embrace them and help them with their own path forward. So I think that when I look at the time period of this book and then I finish reading a section or I finish highlighting, I mean, I should really just send you my book so you can see all the comments I have in the sidebar and the stickies and all those other things. It's also, like you mentioned, it's about feminism. One of the comments Sarah has comes early in the book, and she says, much of being a woman is rendering all effort invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And you have sentences like this throughout the entire book. And I'm loving that you're saying, even though it's about Arthur and Nathaniel, oh my God, those two break my heart. I love them. But you've got these ensemble characters who are just as vocal as our two main characters. Talk about writing this group. Was one louder than the other as you were writing? Did Anne constantly raise her hand and say, listen, I have this to say, or there's a lot of voices that I really appreciated?
I mean, it was so strange writing this book because it's probably, you know, 16 drafts or something like that. Each draft, a different voice kind of led the way. And it was almost like it wanted to be multiple books. But I've always loved Poisonwood Bible by King Solver. Yes, yeah. I always thought that that was a beautiful book. And so I thought, it can be done. You can make all these voices work together under a very powerful male dominant figure. And so I guess with each draft, usually in dialogue, that's where they told me that they were pushing back, right? So Sarah, the daughter of the minister, has basically been passed over in favor of Ezekiel, the younger son. And, you know, that's just how it worked, right? If you had a male son, that's who would take over. But Sarah's infinitely more talented at the ministry than really anybody else in her family. She, one would even say she might be a visionary. Literally, she's visions. And I leave that up to the reader to decide whether or not those visions are real. But to me, she was the real heir to this mission. And for better and worse, right? Because to me, Sarah is becoming a sort of Pentecostal, sort of freer thinker in terms of her expression of religion than even her father was. But she's stifled at every opportunity that she has, except for one, which occurs in about the middle of the book. And she definitely takes that opportunity. And it causes all sorts of problems. You know, so I do think that each of the characters had a moment or two of rebellion. And my main female character that I was really most enraptured with was Catherine. Catherine reminds me a lot of my mother, never really meant to be a preacher's wife, right? She's just too big for any place. And she's smarter almost than everybody else on a kind of instinctual level. She sees things that other people don't see. It was really hard to watch Catherine suffer. She suffers a lot in this book, but she has these little moments, and these moments come out of extreme terror. You know, there's a character that comes in at the end of the book. She was a mentor to her husband, and he knows everything and is ready to destroy everything if her husband doesn't do what he needs. And, you know, she gets rather sassy in some scenes with him. And so it's fun to sort of watch, you know, the challenge was, okay, I want to make this as realistic as possible. What would a woman actually say at this time that she felt like that she could actually say to these men? And I let her walk right up to the edge every time to where she's going to get slapped down or something, but she doesn't.
Oh my, and I'm wondering if you were chuckling along as you were writing that. I'm going to just do this, I'm going to do that.
A little bit. I mean, it wasn't. There were times when I thought, okay, the reader is going to feel that their alliance is with this character, but they're about to go into this other character's head and have that reframed for them. And that was fun because, you know, whatever you're expecting out of this novel, it's probably going to give you something different, which,
you know. But that's the beauty. That's why I've read it, like, however many times, the passages over and over again. And then I'm going to forget, so I don't want to forget. Tell me about choosing the title, All the World Beside. It's just a fantastic title.
Thank you. You know, not everyone loves the title because they think it disappears, but I like it. And the main reason I like it is I was actually having a crisis of my title. And I started texting with the author, Brandon Taylor, who I love.
Yeah.
And he took the author photo as well in the book, which is really fun. So Brandon is the best at titles. Like, I just know he always has a good title. So I said, Brandon, help me. I need something that sounds like the 18th century, but also sounds kind of contemporary. And he looked... God bless him. He looked through sermons. He looked through Jonathan Edwards' titles and things like that. And there was a phrase that kept coming up in Jonathan Edwards' sermons, All the World Beside, as if a Christian must set themselves apart from the rest of the world, right? And that's an idea that's very much present in my dad's church today as well. And so I thought, okay, well, can this be an ironic title? Because it is All the World Beside, because these people are kind of they're not in the center of colonial America. They're sort of in this utopic community. But within that world, there's also something else that's all the world beside. It's this family and what they've gone through and really what Arthur and Nathaniel have gone through. So Brandon Taylor gave me the title. And the minute that I saw it, he actually typed it out. This is how great he is. He typed it out as if it were a title in a document, took pictures of it and sent it to me because he was like, you won't believe it unless you you see it. And so he gave me like five different titles, and I looked, and when I saw All the World Beside, I just thought, that's it.
It's great. I say this often, but there's no other title for this book. Also, the cover, the way it fits on the cover. Tell me about the artistic parts of this cover.
Yeah, for those listening, it's this black and white cover with a Puritan family off to the right bottom side. And then to the left, there's two men walking off together. And they're outlined in it. Is it kind of like a fuchsia, mm-hmm. would you call it?
Yep.
And then the title's also in fuchsia, and my name and all both in black and white. I don't know. It's a very striking cover for me. I think that Riverhead, my publisher, they do really great covers. And I just loved it. The minute I saw it, I loved it. Of course, everyone has an opinion. My husband was like, I don't know. It needs, yeah, everyone has their little thing that they want to change. But my agent and I were very happy with it. So we just never changed it. And the UK was going to be the same.
Good. That was my next question. Will there be a change overseas? But that's wonderful. Keep it as it is. I think it's beautiful. So will readers. Tell me about the audiobook. I know Pete Cross is one of the narrators. Are you also doing some of the narration?
I'm doing the author's note at the end. Okay. They felt that in order to get across this sort of 18th century ironic tone that I have in the author's note, that I needed to go. Because, you know, irony is lost on a lot of people that are reading quickly. You want that voice to come in. I do not want anyone reading that note to think that I side on with the straight historians who make fun of. So they asked me to do that, and I was very excited to do that. But Pete Cross, I mean, these serendipitous things keep happening with my books and Riverhead. I got a list of three people, and I just kind of randomly chose Pete. And he read the book, and he messaged me, like DM'd me on Twitter, and was like, I'm sobbing over here. I don't know how to do this. And we had this really great exchange about the book and what it all means. And he got it. He got everything that I was trying to get across. He's a gay man as well. And so it just sort of, it was this perfect, perfect connection. So I don't know how it keeps happening, but it's sort of a magic.
I cannot wait to listen to it. And what I want to tell listeners is that the narration that Pete Cross will be doing, it's almost not narration. There's so much. The prose is so beautiful and so poetic. There are certain scenes that I just can't wait to listen to. And I will not read the scene because now the pressure's on. But there is a scene very early on where Ezekiel, the baby, is sort of looking up at these trees, and he has this beautiful exchange with his mom. And I won't say anything about that. So go out and get that audiobook the minute it drops, because that's what I'm going to do. So, Garrett, the book hit shelves on March 26th. This episode will air somewhere in that mix. Where is the best place for people, listeners, to follow along with upcoming events when you go out on your tour?
So I'm on my social media, Twitter, I guess X, and Instagram, are @GayRodCon, GayRodCon. So it's kind of a way to remember my name, Garrett. It's Gayrod. GayRodCon. So I do post updates there. I'll be mostly touring in Atlanta, Boston, and New York, but we're hoping to expand that later. Honestly, I'm just exhausted.
I'm sure.
I was like, I don't know if I can do any more events right now. I've been doing events since Boy Race came out.
Yeah.
And I love doing events, and I mean, it's such a privilege. It's a huge privilege to get to do it. So I'm really excited, but I did want to be a little more selective this time. And I'm so proud we were able to book the Center for Fiction on April 9th, I believe, which is in your area. Mm-hmm. It's going to be with Marlon James, who is one of my favorite writers. So I'm just thrilled.
That's a total dream event for me. I mean, that is just like... I'm going to have to camp outside on the sidewalk and just wait with my ticket to get in. I know that you are busy and that you are exhausted. Anything you could share with listeners in terms of books?
Yeah, well, right now I'm reading Oro Kwan's Exhibit, which also is coming out really soon. And I'm loving her sentences. I absolutely, you know, I'm going to be a little Riverhead heavy here. We did an event together, and so they sent me everyone else's books. And of course, I personally love Miranda July. So her new book coming out, All Fours, is just to die for. I mean, it's everything you would expect out of Miranda July, but it goes beyond that. It's funny. It's hard to find a good funny novel, you know? So it's really within that tradition. And I just keep rereading. I've been thinking about doing a kind of Substack, but I'm not sure. So I've been reading, you know, some of the queer classics, and Pedro Lemonbell, who wrote My Tender Matador, is just really, he's becoming one of my favorite writers. Yeah, I'm looking at, I think, a collection of his work that I might blurb soon. I think everyone should read him. Okay. He's fantastic.
All of those recommendations will be on the podcast page for this episode. Anything you can share about what you're working on next?
Ooh, yeah, I can do that. I'm currently working on what I'm calling my big hair novel. It's going to be about televangelists. I'm really obsessed with the TBN network. I don't know if you're aware of that network, the Trinity Broadcast Network. It's a pretty evil venture, but there's a lot of really quirky, fascinating characters in it. And I was really especially interested in Jan Crouch, who's this big kink-haired lady. She looks more Tammy Faye than Tammy Faye. And she, well, all I'll say is that there was an incident reported of abuse that she helped cover up. And I'm very interested in sort of that drama, the woman covering up another woman's incident, and within that world of televangelists. So we'll see.
Now, was that, did you have help with that idea? Was that something, did your husband say, hey, honey,
this came out of the air? I think, you know, really my mom, because my mom is, yeah, she hates it when I compare her to Dolly Parton, but she looks a lot, you know, she has that vibe, which is great to me. I think it's beautiful and fascinating. And so I'm just fascinated with this idea of big hair and like the aesthetic. That's what I'm drawn to at first. You know, it'll be fun.
Listen, I grew up in the 80s in Brooklyn, and you said big hair, and I thought, well, I have pictures to share.
Good. Well, I love big hair. I love it when big hair gets back in. It's always fun. You know, Miley Cyrus had big hair recently.
It was great. Shoulder pads. I'm ready for those to come back too.
Exactly.
Let's do it. Everything old is new again. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Garrett, this has been such a delight. Listeners, All the World Beside by today's guest, Garrett Connolly, is on shelves, well, at the time of this, right now. So please grab a copy at your local library or your local independent bookstore. As we said, All the World Beside is published by Riverhead Books. Garrett, I really am so appreciative of your time. Thank you so much for joining us here on Top Shelf. And I do hope you'll come back for whatever comes next.
Oh, for sure, Caroline. You read so carefully that there's no way I would say no.
And maybe next time I'll show up with my big hair.
It was so good. You did a great interview.
Oh, thank you. Listeners, thanks to all of you for joining both of us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Miera Broderick, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.